Good morning, Your Honor.
May it please the court, Chief Justice Evakin, members of the court, and Mr. Aldridge. My name's Randy Guyatt. I represent the appellant, Rick Development. Before I begin my argument, I want to thank the court for continuing the argument today from its prior scheduled argument. I know that's unusual. I know it was an accommodation to me, and I appreciate it. This case has its genesis in a building that's just about two blocks north of here and a parking lot that's adjacent to that building. And it's important to understand the relationship between the building and the parking lot, because that leads to the issues we're going to talk about today.
Maybe it doesn't make any difference, but is it the one just north of the convenience store?
Yeah, they're at 17th and N, Your Honor. The building's on 17th Street. The parking lot is immediately east of the building. And that's important because the building and the parking lot have been tied together for a number of years, and it's important that they be tied together. And here's why. The building doesn't have any parking. The building's an office building without parking. And so several years ago, the building owners and my client, the owners of the parking lot, entered into a long-term lease, a 50-year lease, that was going to benefit the building, obviously going to benefit my clients who owned the parking lot. Because now the building had parking. Now the building was valuable. Now the building could be leased to tenants. And in fact, that's what happened. The building owners leased a part of the building to the Department of Health and Human Services, entered into a lease that took it through 2014. Now, through a series of transactions that eventually ended up that a company owned or controlled by Mike Roush owned the building, my client continued to own the parking lot. Roush got financing from Cattle National Bank. Roush defaulted on the loan, and so back in 2012, I think it was 2012, 11, somewhere in there, the bank forecloses, exercises a power of sale, gets the building back. The bank doesn't take the building in its name. Instead, it creates a separate corporation, CNBT, which is the appellee today. And CNBT gets the building. And they get it in the form of a trustee's deed, and in the trustee's deed, there's a specific reference to the parking lot. The specific reference to the parking lot is, you're taking it subject to the lease, and it doesn't just say a lease, it specifically describes the lease in question, the long-term 50-year lease. Now, I know that ordinarily, once the building owner in this case, CNBT, goes into possession and it starts to pay the rent, which it did, no question about it, that ordinarily that if CNBT finally leaves and there is no longer privity between my client, Rick, the owner of the parking lot, and CNBT, the owner of the building, if there's no longer any privity, then CNBT would say, as they have here, we don't have any further obligation, and the statute of frauds prevents you, the parking lot owner, from trying to enforce upon us the obligations of the lease. And that's what happened here, and that's what Judge Ott decided, that the statute of frauds prevented enforcement of the lease obligations. Our position is, this wasn't a situation where CNBT just took over the lease and treated it as a month-to-month lease as an assignee. They did much more than that. They acted just as though they had entered into the long-term lease, and it was necessary for them to do that. The reason it was necessary for them to do that is they were reaping the benefits of the lease that CNBT had now with DHHS. And among the provisions in the lease with DHHS, and this is in the record, was an obligation for CNBT to provide parking to DHHS in the parking lot, not on a month-to-month basis, but through the year 2014. And so if it had been just a month-to-month lease, as CNBT now contends, they could not have complied with the lease they had with DHHS. Moreover, they exercised additional rights under the lease that were inconsistent with a month-to-month lease. For example, there was a right of first refusal in the lease that CNBT had with the parking lot, or the original owners of the building had with the parking lot owners, my client, Brick. There was a right of first refusal that said, hey, Brick gets to buy the building if you, the owner of the building, gets an offer on it. And in fact, there was an offer on the building. And when there was an offer on the building, CNBT came to us and said, hey, there's an offer on the building. Do you want to exercise your right of first refusal? That was an act inconsistent with a month-to-month lease. That was an act consistent with recognition that they had obligations under the long-term lease, just like the lease of the spaces to DHS, HHS was recognition that they owed under the long-term lease, not a month-to-month lease. CBMT had another opportunity to sell the building, and in discussing that problem...
Are you contending that that action... Well, I want to distinguish between an action versus vis-a-vis a writing. Are you contending that there was some writing at the time of the offer with respect to the right of first refusal that was sufficient under the statute of frauds? Or is it you're contending that it's an action and relying on this other
I'm case? Contending that it's an action, Your Honor. And with respect to a writing, I concede that there is no direct writing by which CNBT said to BRIC, we will assume the obligations of the long-term lease. There is no such writing. Okay. However, they did accept a deed that said we're accepting the property subject to the lease, which is similar to the deed in the Walters versus Sporer case, where the court said, look, acceptance of that deed, which contained a right of first refusal, is tantamount to a signature. And I think that's what CNBT did here. They recognized that the deed conveyed upon them certain rights, and it's like the Walters versus Sporer case. They ought to be bound by the lease that they acknowledged and that they took the benefits of. And it's our position that they acted as the assignee under the lease, they assumed the lease, and they assumed not just a month-to-month lease, they assumed the long-term lease, just like they acted.
This is maybe too simple. Is this where we're going, that the lease runs with the land?
And that in fact is one of our arguments, that the lease runs with the land. The two were tied together. And I think that that was the intent of CNBT and Cattle National Bank when they put in the trustee's deed recognition of the long-term lease. And it seems to, and as we argue in our brief, the conduct between the parties satisfies the conditions for the lease running with the land. And I think there are a number
of... And a writing.
And the writing, correct. The writing, correct. There are a number of ways in which the properties are tied together and CNBT ought to be legally responsible for the terms of the lease, and that's where we think Judge Ott was wrong. Whether it be that the lease obligation ran with the land, and by land we mean the land of the building, not the land of the lease, as argued in CNBT's brief, that it runs with the land. We also think that the obligations of the lease are binding on CNBT because their conduct acknowledges that they intended for the lease to run with land. Because really what they're doing is what they were saying, as long as the lease benefited us, not on a month-to-month basis, but as long as the long-term lease benefited us, we're going to act like we had the long-term lease. But as soon as it didn't benefit us, which was the date DHHS moved out, then they wanted to say, well, it's only a month-to-month lease. And
so
for that reason...
there's a kind of estoppel.
Exactly, and that leads to our estoppel argument. They were intending to have it both ways. CNBT is a sophisticated business. They are trying to use the statute of frauds contrary to its intended purpose. The policy of the statute of frauds is to prevent a fraud. Here there's no question that CNBT knew about the long-term lease. Nobody's perpetuating a fraud on CNBT. What they're doing is using the statute of frauds to avoid an obligation that they wanted to have because it benefited them right up until the time they apparently made the decision that it did not benefit them. And then the final part of our argument is that the facts show that the obligations of the lease clearly ran with the land. I don't know the reason for including the subject to language in the trustee's deed. In fact, Judge Ott acknowledged that. He said the language is curious, but what the language really did is cause the lease to run with the land. And we're asking that the court reverse the action of the district court, remand it, either finding that our motion for summary judgment should have been sustained, or that the motion of CNBT for summary judgment be overruled and the case be remanded to be tried for any factual issues. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Aldridge, good morning to you.
My papers, I'm sorry. Good morning. Derek Aldridge here on behalf of the Appalachian CNBT2 LLC and the Cattle National Bank and Trust Company, now known as Cattle Bank and Trust. Summarizing, the district court was correct in finding the statute of limitations barred the appellant's claim for breach of the parking lot lease.
You mean statute of frauds.
Statute of frauds, yes. I'm sorry.
You said limitations.
Statute of frauds.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
District court was also correct in finding that equitable estoppel did not prevent the appellees from relying on the statute of frauds as a defense. Statute of frauds we're talking about here is revised statute 36105, says written leases in excess of a year need to be in writing and signed by the parties bound. I think it's key here to understand that we have to follow the chain as we go. It's not disputed that the original lease between the Smiths and TTE is that writing satisfying the statute of frauds. To go from TTE, which was the original tenant, you step down to Roush, which is the next subtenant, there is an assignment of lease. That's Exhibit 6. That's not a complicated document. It's 2 pages long. It's a writing signed by the parties satisfying the statute of frauds, but it also satisfies the requirements for assignment under Nebraska law. TTE says they're assigning right title and liability, rights and titles of the lease to Roush. Roush accepts assignment of rights and title, and Roush assumes obligations and liabilities under the lease. And then it also contains a provision under the lease which required the landlord to consent to it. It's a 2-page document. It's not that difficult to have drafted. And Brick and Smiths, being sophisticated business entities, they could find a way to have a document like that created. Where this falls apart is the steps from there down. The bank takes a deed of trust, or it's really what it is that Roush grants a deed of trust. They grant the building as collateral through a deed of trust. And when you look at that deed of trust, it describes the building. It doesn't describe the parking lot. It doesn't describe the parking lot lease. So Roush never granted a security interest in the parking lot lease. Now, the appellants have talked about, well, you know, there's paragraph 12, which is assignments of rents and lease provision. And there's some misinterpretation of the language. The language there says it's leases for the use and occupancy of the property being the building. It's use of the building, not use of the parking lot. It would be, their argument is essentially that the parking lot was used by the tenants of the building.
So, let me catch up. Lease refers to which lease?
The parking lot lease?
Within the deed, yeah, the deed of trust. Lease refers to what? What lease?
Leases
within the building.
Of the building. Within the building.
Lease pertaining to the parking lot.
Not pertaining to the parking lot. It's leases of the space within the building. And that's consistent with the notion that it's an assignment of leases and rents. So it's rents that the building owner is going to receive from tenants in the building.
In the deed of trust, describing what's being conveyed in trust, does it contain the same language that shows up ultimately in the trustee's deed of non-judicial foreclosure, subject to?
No, it does not. The deed of trust does not anywhere specifically describe either the parking lot or the parking lot lease. And so really the problem is,
does it encompass leases within the building?
Within the building. And rents that the landlord Roush would receive.
Pertaining directly to the building.
Correct.
Encompassed with it.
Correct.
As opposed to some, here I go, Heredemont. Perhaps the parking lot.
So does the record tell us how that language got into the trustee's deed?
It does not. it's there. It was. I think there is an exhibit of the recital of what the attorney at the trustee sale recited, and it's consistent with the language that's in the trustee's deed. But and moving on into the trustee's deed, I mean, this court has said with trustee's deed, the doctrine of caveat emptor applies. So it's the purchaser is bound to to examine the title and not rely on statements that are made by the officer conducting the sale. So that language is not in the deed of trust. The parking lot and the parking lot lease were not collateral for that deed of trust. It never was part of the sale. And again, when you look at the deed of trust...
Is this a discrepancy? Is that your view between the deed of trust and the trustee's deed?
No. I think the trustee's deed never... Or the deed of trust didn't collect the lease as collateral.
Is the language, the word lease, is it being used differently in deed of trust and trustee's deed?
You mean specifically the parking lot lease?
Yeah.
And how did it get into the trustee's deed? The record's not clear on how that happened.
Is all of this stuff, like, of record, like, could be found in the clerk's office?
Well, I don't think the register of deed could find it. Because, again, when you look specifically at the real estate, the legal description that was identified, it was the building. So you literally walk that to the register of deeds, and the clerk at that office is going to say, okay, where do I index this against? And the legal is going to be the building. The deed of trust is just the building. The deed of trust on the trustee's deed is just the building.
The deed of trust, which was foreclosed later.
Correct.
Is that in our record?
It is. It is. It is at Exhibit 7. So there is, as Judge Ott mentioned, there is curious language in the trustee's deed, but it's not consistent with what is in the deed of trust. So, for example, transfer of the real estate subject to the following. Well, subject to, if they wanted to be an assignment, they would have used the word assignment, not subject to. This court in Lexington Bank versus Sailing, and we identify this in our brief, acceptance of a deed in which express terms conveys land subject to an encumbrance does not impose upon the grantee the personal obligation. So
but
subject
didn't,
to...
Didn't your client ultimately treat the parking lot, use the parking lot as if it was subject to?
Short answer, no. Under privity of estate concepts, they paid rent, which is a defined or an understood covenant that runs with the land. So in leases, and this court has said this admittedly a long time ago, Mayer versus Dwiggins, 114 Neb 184, it's a 1925 case.
In the brief, right?
It's not in the brief. Mayer versus Dwiggins, 114 Neb 184. At common law, a lessee during his occupation holds both privity of estate and privity of contract. And this is also very well laid out in the California case that was cited by the district court in their opinion. It's a very similar concept. Privity of estate, privity of contract. Privity of estate, the obligations are those promises in the contract that run with the land. Okay, and so in this case, we're talking one of the most well understood covenants that run with the land is rent. Regardless of whether you're in privity of contract, if you are in possession or occupation of leased ground, you have that obligation to pay rent, and that's what CNBT in this case did. They honored the obligation under privity of estate to pay rent, but they were not under privity of contract because there was nothing. There was no writing signed by CNBT in which they assumed, in which they were either assigned contract rights and title, or assumed obligation and liability under that.
So they could bail any time?
Well, it was month to month. I wouldn't say bail.
Why is it month to month? Where is that coming
from? Privity of estate. There's no contract. There's no privity of contract. There's nothing that obligated them to stay for any particular time. So they indicated...
So after a one-year lease, it's month to month.
As a whole, I think that's...
As a general notion.
As a general notion, right. As a holdover, correct. Correct. So again, our contention is there isn't a trail of documents to get to CNBT to bind them under privity of contract to all of the other terms of the contract. In regards to the covenant that runs with the land argument that was mentioned by counsel, you know, that's a peculiar argument to say that the parking lot lease, the entire lease, is a covenant that runs with the building. That's a peculiar lease. You might say that the covenants of a lease run with the land that the lease is in. So you might have covenants in the parking lot lease that run with the parking lot building. But to say the entire lease runs as a covenant against the building is a peculiar argument to make.
Before your time completely expires, your opponent spoke about the effect of a lease of the building to HHS. How does that relate to this?
Not relevant. Not relevant to this case at all. The appellant's not a party to that contract. They don't get any benefits in that contract. They're not a party to it. Those are simply promises between the building owner and its tenants. If it creates a hardship on the building owner because they have a problem leasing the parking lot next door, that's a problem for the building owner. But the appellants are just not a party to those agreements. They're not relevant to them at all. I see that my time is up. Again, I would ask that this court affirm the judgment of the district court, as well as affirming that the appellees have no obligations under the notice of lease and rights of first refusal filed by the appellant against the building property. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
Yes, 7 seconds.
7 seconds. Mr. Guyette, is there something you want to say?
I'll wait my 7 seconds, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. That concludes arguments for the day. The court is adjourned and you are excused.